howdy there, friends. And thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And as always, sitting across from me, the man that puts fun in dysfunction, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm excited to be here. The weather is beautiful here in Texas. It doesn't even feel like winter.
I feel bad for everyone that's been fighting it the last few weeks along the East Coast.
Oh, man.
Because it is literally in the 70s, pushing 80s down here right now.
And if you do have to get out and shovel snow, please be careful. Our friend Jeff Adams said he realized he got in trouble. I hope you're feeling better, Jeff.
Sorry, yeah, take care, Jeff. We saw you vapor locked while he was doing a little snow shoveling. So be careful, bro. Look, hey, man, Jeff, get you a snowblower, bro. Have some kids come do it. Come on, take it easy, man. Take it easy. Get out there snuffling snow.
Yeah, please be careful. But yeah, we're going to have a pretty interesting show today. Today we're going to be talking about a cursed submarine, some scary encounters people had along a cruise ship, and all that plus more. But Cam, what was it you were telling me off air about eye contact?
Yeah, you're going to like this, folks. We always go through this one, like when you glance over and see somebody and everybody give you like the 50-cent head nod or something real easy, you know, like that. But apparently this is really a thing that they've been looking into. This comes from Scientific American. It says eye contact, how long is too long? And they go in to talk about that researchers have long known that eye contact is a very important social signal. I know when you meet somebody, you know, you want to walk up and shake their hands. You want to make eye contact with those people. When you're talking, lots of times you want to make sure that you make eye contact with those people. It says our recognition of its importance may actually even be hardwired into our body. Now, it says that they did a study that five-day-old babies prefer looking at faces that make direct eye contact compared with faces that avert their gaze. Now, James Worth, now he's a social psychologist at Ohio State University in Newark, says eye contact provides some of the strongest information during a social interaction. And he said because it conveys details about emotions and intentions. And he even says that the lack of eye contact is one of the earlier signs of autism in infants and toddlers. I did not know that.
I didn't know that either.
There's a lack of eye contact. So apparently they even did a 2010 study that was co-authored by James, that the power of eye contact is so great that if someone avoids your gaze for a short period, you feel ostracized by that person.
Hmm.
Now, in 2015 of May, Vision Sciences Society Conference, psychologist Alan Johnston and his colleagues at the University College in London collected information from more than 400 volunteers about their personalities. Then the subjects indicated their comfort level while watching video clips of actors who appeared to be looking directly at them for varying lengths of time. And they found out that on average, subjects liked the actors that make eye contact with them for 3.2 seconds. But the subjects were comfortable with longer duration if they felt the actors looked trustworthy as opposed to threatening.
Hmm.
Now it says gaze, this is what he says, gaze conveys. That's my new band name, Gaze Conveys, that you are an object of interest and interest is linked to intention. So if someone appears threatening and holds your gaze, that could indicate that the person has bad intentions.
Yeah.
That says our reaction to prolonged eye contact may relate to how we perceive ourselves also. Johnson and his group found that the more cooperative and warm subjects believe themselves to be, the longer they liked eye contact to be held.
Yeah, even though it really does make sense. I mean, when you get a first impression with somebody, everybody's met somebody, and you're like, man, the guy wouldn't even look at me hardly.
Yeah.
I don't know if I trust this guy. And then the opposite is like, man, what does that person keep staring at me for?
Yeah. He actually goes on to speculate in this article that the more socially comfortable a person feels, the more he or she may enjoy the intimacy of a mutual gaze. And here's what's funny, as I thought about this, is you can be in a group, and I mean, and I'm sure it's happened to the men and the women that are listening to this show before, is maybe you're with somebody. Maybe it's your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your wife, your husband, whatever. But maybe you are attracted to another person. That doesn't mean you're going to act on it. But maybe you're like, man, that girl is or that guy is really nice. He's really hot. I mean, I love my boyfriend or whatever, the whole thing, but I'm really attracted to that person.
Yeah.
You ever feel that way? And then you look up and you see them looking at you. And it's almost like for a split second, you can kind of share something. And it's almost like you can feel that same attraction.
It's weird.
It's strange how you can convey that. And we had talked earlier in the month about glaring, where people are, they did the studies where they know of people staring at you, you can feel it. You know of people looking at you like that.
Yeah, I remember,
you know,
a guy emailed us that he was like special forces or something.
Yes.
And he said that during training, when they're talking about sneaking up on a sentry or a guard to take them out, they said that they're taught not to stare at the person's back as you're sneaking up on them because they can sense
They'll feel it.
Yeah.
So it makes sense of this whole thing is that you can share a lot of intimacy and a lot of your feelings just through eye contact.
Well, what do they talk about tigers? People walk through the woods, they'll put those faces on their
masks. Yeah.
If it thinks that you're looking that way, it won't sneak up on you.
How wild is that? Those little bitty things like that, you know, it's pretty, like they always say, it's the windows to the soul. Maybe it truly, there's something to that.
Yeah. Well, speaking of eyes, I got this new recent black-eyed kid
encounter. Oh, I didn't. You snuck that in on me, you sorry dog. Now, you just played off my eye contact thing.
Perfect.
You're so dirty.
Perfect. This comes from Two Crows Paranormal, you know, David Weatherly's
yeah.
site. And this was relayed to him by a researcher named Jamie Bryan, who transcribed this account from another radio station, and that's Darkness Radio. And it's very interesting. Let's take a listen. I've never told anybody about this because it scared the living bejesus out of me. It happened about 4 years ago on one of my properties when I was out hunting. Now, I wasn't alone. I had my dog with me, and I also had my shotgun with me, a semi-automatic. And I was out walking through the woods on the outskirts of my property. It's about 65 acres. Anyway, I was pretty deep in the woods that day, and I came across something where the hairs on the back of my neck stood up, even before I saw it. It was a little girl. She had on a little blue nightie, the gangliest, sickliest looking thing I've ever seen in my life. Now, it didn't see me at first, and my dog, he went straight to the ground and started whining, and it heard him, and it turned to me, and it looked at me with the blackest eyes. Now, this was in broad daylight, the blackest eyes I've ever seen in my entire life, and I took a pot shot at it. With my scope, I hit it, and I thought I killed it. The dog stayed right where it was, and I went running off. I checked, and there was nothing there. Nothing. All I saw were little bare footprints in the dirt in the area where it was standing. Now, I have not walked on the property since. This thing, it looked like a little girl, maybe 10 or 11. It had white gangly hair. It was like if you dehydrated a little kid. That's what its skin was like. I was no more than maybe 90 feet from it when I shot at it. And I was behind two trees. And when I came out from behind the trees to shoot, it was already staring at us. I barely got off enough courage to pull the trigger, because it frightened me. Almost half to death. I mean, I was froze for the longest time. All I heard was this screech, and I saw it hit the ground, and I immediately ran toward it. But when I got there, there was nothing there. There was no blood, just footprints all over the place in circles. And when I first initially saw it, it was sniffing the air like it was hunting. No little girl at 6 o'clock in the morning, on a foggy morning, in the middle of a 65-acre property, is going to be out there sniffing the air. That's what blew my mind at first. When I saw it, I thought it was a little girl. I almost called out to it, but when I saw the way it was standing kind of like it was crouched a little bit and sniffing the air. I mean, it took everything I had to take a pot shot at this thing. I mean, I served in the military. I've seen some things in the jungles in South America. This thing scared the piss out of me. This thing that I saw, it had one of the most malevolent feelings that I've ever had. It felt like danger. Well, I wouldn't have immediately called the police if that's what the case, you know. But this was not a little girl. It would have been there after I shot it if it was. There was nothing but these little footprints all over the place. Now, that is a terrifying story, right?
That is an extremely unnerving tale.
Yeah, I mean, he says, look, you know, it looked sickly, it looked skinny, it had the black eyes, it gave him a terrible feeling, and he shot it. I don't know that I would have shot at it, because my first instinct was like, yeah, like, you know, maybe this is a homeless girl or something. I mean, I know it's got black eyes, but
yeah,
maybe I'm seeing something. His first instinct was to take a shot at it. But, you know, that's him. He's there feeling that fear. See,
yes.
Me just reading the story, it's easy for me to say what I would have done.
Here's what's
crazy.
In
that circumstance, though, you might think, you know, act much differently.
We've done it several times and, you know, had the YouTube videos up of us talking with the black-eyed kids. And when we've talked to David Weatherly on air and off air, you know, about it and about other things also. so many people, and I even went back to the very first story of it and covered the very first report from the reporter that says of what he saw and all that. Very easily could have been a hoax, I suppose. But it's so strange to me that so many people write off every one of these stories as it's a hoax. But just because, the same as the Slender Man, you know, everybody, we know the background. We've covered the background too. But then we've also covered some background in it where people had seen this thing before, had reported these stories before. It had kind of came out like on Creepypasta and stuff.
It just
like
wasn't
that.
Called Black Eyed Kids, or it wasn't called Slender Man.
Exactly. So you see that now. But then what's the answer for it now? Like stuff like that. It's almost like we ourselves manifested this evil, manifested this because we all think about it. And we all, and it's almost like we're the ones that breathed life into this thing.
Terrifying, really.
It's not cool. It's not cool at all.
No.
I'm going to change it up. We're going to have a little bit more fun. We're going to get away from this creepy stuff and all that. We're going to talk a little ancient history. WesternDigs.org covered this. They said that there's been nearly 20 stone tool sites dating back as far as 12,000 years discovered in Nevada now.
Really?
Yeah. Now, there's long lakes and streams that have long since vanished, okay?
Yeah.
Archaeologists working in southern Nevada have found nearly 20 sites used by these ancient hunter-gatherers as much as 12,000 years ago. But these weren't, they're remote, yes, but they're not basically discovered by accident, because that's what you would think, is somebody was out and they found these tools and they called an archaeologist and they come, state archaeologist looked at it. No, that's not what happened. About 100 miles northeast of Las Vegas, there's some researchers from the firm, this Utah-based firm of Logan Simpson. And they discovered 19 separate sites containing a variety of what they're calling stone points, bifaced blades, and other artifacts associated with Paleo-Archaic period. And that's the period between 7,000 and 12,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, Mr. Jesse Adams, an archaeologist, he led this new study. Now, it's cool about what they did. I'm gonna say, this is what he said. He said the Pliocene-Holocene transition period, Pleistocene, I'm sorry, is a little known but a fascinating time. Now, he's the senior archaeologist there with Logan Simpson. He says, especially to everyone in our office, as we have identified similarly aged sites during other projects in the Great Basin, which piqued our interest. So the reason it kind of got drawn into this for me was, like we've always said, are these simple hunter-gatherers and all this, or are these still part of the surviving culture of people after the last ice age, after all this was here?
Right.
You know, you start thinking about it this way. Now, he said that him and his team, they found these sites. They use a technique known as predictive modeling. I never even heard of this, but what they do is they use identifying qualities of previous known locations and what they have in common.
Right.
So they go and they look basically like a crime scene. You look at what this all has in common, then you look for other areas in these areas that have this in common where they basically might be. So the previous research in the Great Basin there had shown signs of human activity in that late Pleistocene. And that most often are found around certain kinds of land formations, which makes sense. Land formations near water, near marshlands.
Right, yeah.
You think of areas where it would be good for people to live.
That's where people are going to be. You're always going to be near water sources.
Yes. But here's the cool thing, too, is they even went so far back as to take the predictive changing of the environment and predict where water would have been in that time period. So they may have been way in the remote desert, but it may used to have been water and marshlands. So they even
looks like
we're
Egypt, ancient Egypt, the plateau and stuff. That was, you know, rainforest at one time.
So they look for all of this, and that's what led them to it. They found like channels and other landforms that you wouldn't normally have noticed till you use these programs to go through. Now they got funding from the Bureau of Land Management's Lincoln County Archaeological Initiative. So they used all this stuff. They go to this where they think this Pleistocene-Holocene activity might be there. Used all this stuff, and this is what Adam said. The Lincoln County Archaeological Initiative offered an opportunity to create and refine the technique that they call GIS that would more effectively identify where these rare site types are located on the landscape. So basically, they map the land with that, with the GIS and aerial photos, and then a few other tools, and then they pinpoint what they think, all the researchers together, are the most promising locations. So they rank them, two, three. Then they go to the first one and start working through it. He says that these areas were then ground-truthed and resulted in several landforms of interest. So they found fluted and stemmed arrowheads and spear points, like Clovis style points.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, that's what they'd end up finding in a lot of this stuff. Some of it, and that's even known to date back to the Paleoarchaic epoch. So they've dug through all this stuff and used basically modern technology to project all this. So how much till we start looking at other places? Like we've talked about, we always wanted them to wish somebody would set up some way or some map or some something where they could drain the oceans of 400 feet. Just to recede back from where we are right now, 400 foot further back, to expose that and then study all that area. Start looking at all the culture cool. That's underwater, all the areas. Because look at all the shoreline on all the continents. There's no telling what's out there underwater that we couldn't find. Of course, a lot of it's gone. But if there was any great megalithic structure, there's a lot of it we may know nothing of.
It's happening now.
Yes.
The glaciers are melting. The sea's rising. We know it's going to rise.
Yeah.
So a lot of stuff that's on the ocean is going to be underwater.
It's going to be underwater. I would just like to know what's out there. So hopefully they'll use this. And it's the same thing. Is I think we're going to end up start pinpointing more and more stuff without the need of where you're not wasting people's time and money and effort where you can go, okay, this is where we start our search.
Right.
So we're going to use this computer to kind of knock that down. But anyway, I was really excited to see what they're going to find there now.
Me too. That's pretty cool. Well, let's take a break, folks. And when we get back from the break, we're going to get into this cursed or haunted submarine. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Cam, on this show, we do a lot of different subjects. And we've explored lots of different topics, whether it's time slips or secret bases on the moon or the Ararat anomaly or, early pre-Columbian visitors, UFOs, the Roswell incident and stuff like that. But we only a few times have ever brought up the concept of ghosts. I remember one time we did an episode on ghost ships, which was very interesting. But have you ever heard of haunted or ghost submarines?
No.
Right?
I'm like, man, you caught me off guard with the ghost submarines.
Haunted or ghost submarines. There are stories, believe it or not, of some of these German U-boats that were destroyed. And then later they're seen nowadays. Every once in a while they'll see it and it looks like a rusted submarine surfacing.
That's cool.
People see them, but if they drive towards it, the thing always vanishes or disappears beneath the waves. There's also, they believe that at the time, and this is just in World War II, like they had like 600-something U-boats, and all of them were accounted for except for like 60, and they don't know. Most likely, they were either scuttled by the crew themselves, mm-hmm. or they were sunk and just never were found.
The Nautilus.
But there are a few that they believe have maybe even escaped.
And they went to like an island, and then they were built and turned into the Nautilus because some crazy sea captain.
You got some of these crazy stories like that, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today. I didn't even realize just how long submarines have been around. I mean, I always thought it was something that was only like, 100 years old.
So this is what you brought up to me the other day when you were asking me this question, you sneaky son of a gun, because you were like, hey, you know how long subs have been around? These are the kind of questions that we ask each other out of the blue. I'm like, nah, man, I don't know, 100 years?
Well, because I want to get your thought, because if I bring up a subject and you're like, nah, man, that's crap. And I'm like, okay, scratch that to myself. I'm like, I would never think of doing a show on that.
Yeah, right. No, I thought it was dumb, too.
I feel you out when you're like, oh, man, that's really interesting. I'm like,
yeah, I was blown up because I, like I told you, I'm like, Civil War? Undoubtedly, I was a little bit, didn't go back far enough. I was a little wrong.
Yeah, pretty interesting. Let's get into this. The concept of underwater combat goes back a long, long time. Much longer than you would actually think. Some of the first devices were just men using hollow sticks to remain underwater as they moved into attack position, and then would spring out of the water and attack their unsuspecting victims. Sometime later, early submersibles were created, sort of like a large bell. These devices were used for sneaking behind enemy lines from beneath the water, as well as giving divers the ability to clear obstacles or obstructions in harbors, for instance. At the Siege of Tyre 332 BC. Alexander the Great used divers, according to Aristotle. Later, legends from Alexandria, Egypt, from the 12th century AD, suggested that Alexander conducted clandestine reconnaissance using primitive submersibles in the form of crude diving bells, as depicted in a 16th century Islamic painting. Another report talks about how two Greeks submerged and surfaced in the River Tagus near the city of Toledo several times in the presence of the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, without even getting wet, and with the flame they carried in their hands still alight. Even though it seems that there were many planned submersibles or submarines during the Middle Ages, the Englishman William Bourne, spelt just like Jason Bourne from the movies, built the first workable prototype submarine in 1578. This was a completely enclosed wooden boat that could be submerged and rowed from beneath the surface. Now, this early underwater vessel was sheathed in waterproof leather and used a hand-operated wooden screw thread that could adjust little plungers that pressed against flexible leather bags located on the sides in order to increase or decrease the buoyancy of the craft. The very first submarine built in modern times was constructed in 1620 by Cornelius Jacobszoon Drebbel. They believed this was based on Bourne's original idea. It, too, was propelled by oars and incorporated floats with tubes down to the rowers that brought them air. It didn't take long before people began to understand the military importance of the submarine, and they were quickly adopted to many military campaigns. The first American submarine was called the Turtle in 1776. It was a hand-powered, egg-shaped device built by a man named David Bushnell, and it accommodated only one man. It was the first submarine to actually use screws for propulsion rather than oars. Over the years, submarines continued to be improved upon, but only got reliable in the 1880s with the advent of the electric battery and its technology. Of all of the countries that excelled in submersibles, it seemed none did it better than the Germans. During World War I and II, the Germans ruled the subsurface seas in their U-boats, or Unterseeboot, which literally means undersea boat. Now, these U-boats were a real nightmare for any sea-going vessel at the time, but especially merchant and supply ships. At the time, the typical U-boat was 214 feet long. It carried 35 men, and it carried also 12 torpedoes. It could travel underwater for 2 hours at a time. And one of the most famous sinkings of all time took place on May 7th, 1915, off the coast of Ireland. The Lusitania was torpedoed without warning. And of the 1,959 passengers on board, 1,198 killed. 128 of those were Americans. The Germans were so good at sinking ships, and their submarines were so superior to everyone else's, that they were able to achieve incredible numbers like no one else. In both world wars, they were able to sink a staggering 2,779 ships. Roughly 70% of all Allied shipping losses were attributed to German U-boats. Although these undersea specters of death terrorized the enemy, it would prove that there were some mysterious forces at work aboard one U-boat that would go on to terrorize its own crew just as much as it terrorized anyone else. This would later cement this famous boat in the legends of so many other sea-going tales. The submarine in question was the UB-65. Now, this was a type UB-3 U-boat, not a UB-40 like Red Red Wine. It was built by the German Imperial Navy in 1916. And before it was even finished being built, it had already killed one man. It went on to be blamed for numerous deaths during its construction, which led some to believe that it was cursed. In one instance, while the hull was being built, a huge steel girder fell to the ground when one of the many support chains snapped. The girder fell on two workers, killing one of them instantly. Another incident killed three engineers who were testing the dry cell batteries when the room they were in was filled with noxious diesel fumes. The deadly fumes incapacitated the men, and they had all asphyxiated by the time rescuers could arrive with any help. No one knows what caused this mysterious leak. After the completion of the ship, the dark complications continued. During one of the early routine test runs to determine the sea readiness of the ship, UB-65 ran into a fierce storm that seemed to come out of nowhere. During the storm, one of the crew members was swept overboard. His body was never seen again. When the ship later tried to test dive, one of the ballast tanks was damaged and the dry cell batteries flooded with seawater, which once again filled the engine compartment with poisonous gas, killing two more crew members. On another test run, on a separate incident, the crew was going once again to test the sub's diving capability when again one of the ballast tanks ruptured. The sub was inundated with seawater, and the UB-65 sank quickly, now resting on the bottom of the ocean floor with the crew in a mad panic. They began to question how long until the air ran out. The crew worked hard to make the necessary repairs, and after 12 hours, the ship was finally fixed and was able to surface again before any of the air ran out. After that incident, everyone in the German Navy began to refer to UB-65 as a cursed vessel. Even with all the whispers, the ship was cleared and declared seaworthy in 1917. With its maiden voyage planned, the sailors began loading supplies and ordnance. As the torpedoes were being lowered, one of them slipped and exploded, which damaged the ship, injured dozens, and actually killed the sub's second officer, a Lieutenant Richter. Now, not only was the UB-65 being considered a cursed vessel, but it appeared to be shaping up to being a haunted vessel as well. The very first ghost sighting was made up in the ship's conning tower. The lookout was up in the tower when he noticed someone standing down on the deck directly below him, which was unusual since all of the hatches had already been battened down. No one should be there. When the ghostly figure finally looked up, the lookout could clearly see it was the face of Lieutenant Richter, the second officer who had been killed by the exploding torpedo. The ghostly Richter reportedly shouted some sort of warning and then disappeared when the lookout began screaming in terror. Shortly after this, a panicked crewman ran to tell the others what he had seen, and the dead Richter casually was strolling about on the deck. The captain thought the crewman was just seeing things, but nevertheless, he went to investigate the deck himself, where he found another crewman cowering in fright near the conning tower. Now, this terrified crewman confirmed the story and explained that the dead second officer had sort of hovered off of the ground up the gangplank along the bow and had stopped to look out over the sea before simply vanishing into thin air. After all of this, the ghost of Lieutenant Richter was seen more and more often. One man saw him in the engine room, just looking over the gauges and panels, before eventually disappearing into thin air. On another occasion, he was seen standing on top of the conning tower during a violent storm. Most of the time, he was seen wandering the various hallways and passageways of the submarine. Sometimes, he was even seen walking through the walls. By this time, the captain of the U-boat had had enough It would try to discourage any of these stories of these ghosts. It would even pass out terrible punishments for those that dared to speak out against the curse, and so on. The captain's own viewpoint would change somewhat when he saw the ghost of Richter one night with his own eyes. During one storm, the sub was ordered to surface in order to survey the situation of the rough seas. As a crew member peered through a hatch to scan the horizon, he was shocked to see a lone figure standing out on the deck. Now, two things made this instantly stand out. For one, only a crazy person would be standing out on the deck in a storm like this. And two, all of the hatches were already sealed. The figure then turned around to reveal that he was Richter, after which the frightened captain shouted down to the others that he could see the ghost. The submarine's infamy continued. Many sailors outright refused to serve a boarder, and the ones that did wanted very much to get off. Crew morale spiraled downward in the face of these paranormal occurrences, and everyone was fairly exhausted and shaken. Many of the crew members were reassigned to other vessels in the face of their growing dread. The German Imperial Navy even went as far as to have a Lutheran pastor perform an exorcism on the vessel in order to dispel the crew's fears. In an effort to get to the bottom of what was going on, the Germans assigned a Commodore to UB-65 in order to investigate the situation. After carefully interviewing the crew members, he became convinced that they were telling the truth. Nevertheless, the Imperial Navy decided that enough was enough and decided to assign a new captain to UB-65. This new captain was very no-nonsense, and he was determined not to allow a hint of any ghost stories aboard the ship. After the change of command, UB-65 completed two tours of duty without one incident. But whatever force was lurking within the confines of the sub were merely dormant, not gone. In May of 1918, UB-65 was engaged in the task of patrolling the supply lanes in the English Channel off of Spain. During this mission, one officer reported seeing a shadowy figure enter the torpedo room, that when he went to investigate, there was no one there. One other time, one of the crewmen said that he had seen a ghost walk right through the thick iron wall straight into the engine room. Also, a torpedo gunner said that the ghost of Lieutenant Richter had been harassing him for several nights in a row. The experience reportedly drove him mad, and one night, the disturbed crewman climbed out onto the upper deck of the submarine when it surfaced to recharge its batteries and hurled himself into the sea. His body was never recovered. On July 10th, 1918, off Padstow, Cornwall, on the Irish coast, an American submarine came across UB-65 as it was at the surface. The American sub immediately prepared for attack. Yet bizarrely, as the torpedoes were being loaded and preparing to fire, UB-65 suddenly exploded into a rain of debris. For apparently no reason at all. The perplexed Americans had certainly not fired, and there were no other vessels in the immediate vicinity at the time that it could be blamed upon. It was presumed that UB-65 had experienced some sort of malfunction, and its weapon system had become corrupted and had been sunk by its own torpedoes. But no one knows for sure. No one knows what caused the explosion. All of the UB-65's crew, which was 37, were killed, and none of the bodies were ever found. Adding to the mystery was the account of one American officer who reported seeing a lone figure in a German officer's overcoat standing on the deck with its arms folded shortly before the mysterious explosion occurred. For a long time, the wreckage of UB-65 could not be located, and the mystery of its explosion and sinking over the years became a perplexing maritime mystery. The wreck was finally found and identified by underwater archaeologists in 2004. So what happened to UB-65? Was it really cursed? Or was it just a string of bad coincidences, fueled by tall tales, spread among sailors? So what do you think of that story, Cam? Pretty interesting.
It's almost too much for it to be, like we always talk about, a coincidence. There's too many things, man.
The whole time.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest. These submarines, they're created for no other purpose than to cause mayhem and havoc and death. I mean, that's what they're designed to do, is to sneak around and blow stuff up. And we talked about all the merchant ships and innocent people that were killed by these sinking. It wasn't like the submarine was only sinking warships. That's the problem.
It kind of had the bad mojo already on it.
Yeah, they were talking about, you know, when you were, if you were to sail from New York to England during that time period, that you were taking a really big chance because they were just sinking ships with people on it. Women, children, men, innocent people. They would drown, you know, or be killed in the actual explosion. So these things, these actual submarines, are harbingers for death. Could they have somehow become actually cursed themselves?
Well, it's even like some of the pirate ships and stuff that they talk about. And even some of, look, no matter what side of war you're on, you may feel like you're doing the right thing, but you're killing someone else's, you know, children. That's what you're doing.
Yeah.
So the people on, you know, everybody on our side thinks we're doing the right thing. Everybody on the enemy side thinks they're doing the right thing. So it's, is it bad energy or something? I mean, because it feels like it. But just like that, like you were talking about, this is attacking anybody. It almost seems like once you cross the line, like if you're committed to a fight, be like, if you and I said, okay, when we get done with this show, we're going to get out in the backyard and we're going to go at it. We're going to agree. That's what we're going to do.
Right.
It's completely different. Then we get done with this show and I just walk around the side of the table and just start punching you. There's a whole different level.
Right.
It's not the same thing. And almost like that underlying evilness in itself of doing what they were doing to these unknown people, just attacking, almost seems like that's what brings it on them. It's karma. That's what it is. It's submarine karma. It's what you're dealing with.
Yeah, I had no idea. I mean, 2,700 ships they sank? The German U-boats? I mean, that's a lot.
That's doing some work. That's doing work is what that is.
That's a lot.
Yes.
Yeah, it really is very interesting. Now, I had mentioned earlier in the show that we had done an actual episode on ghost ships. Do you remember that?
Yes.
We talked about the Flying Dutchman and the Mary Celeste and all these other famous ones. I recently found a new one that somebody passed along to me. Have you ever heard of El Colucci? I never thought of this.
El Chapo's cousin.
Yeah, you're right.
He's one of the narcos. Yeah, I've heard of El Colucci. I heard what he sells is brown sugar, though. He's one of those guys, he don't like to take edges, so he sells a lot of brown sugar. That's right? What he does.
It's kind of like an El Colucci. You ever go to West Texas? I mean, the town West.
Yeah, right.
They got some good Colucci's there. Anyways, El Colucci is a ghost ship that is said to sail the waters off the coast of Chile. Now, El Colucci always sails at night, and it appears suddenly through the fog or mist, and it's usually brightly lit, writes an author, Ann Brigham, in her book South and Mesoamerican Mythology. Now, this ship is said, this is just a legend, to guard the waters and punish those who bring hardship to the sea or the creatures that live in it. Now, the ship's crew is said to consist of dead, shipwrecked sailors, along with witches. Now, the witches are said to leave the ship by riding a seahorse named Caballo Marino Bingham. Now, apparently these witches are shipwrecked sailors, and they're a happy crew. On calm nights, it's said that you can hear music and laughter and also other things coming from the ship. Now, of course, this is like an urban legend. You know what I mean? It's not real, I don't believe. Of course, there's going to be people, I'm sure somebody's going to send me an email from Chile saying, oh, me and my cousin saw it. But it is neat. You know, you talk about these.
It sounds like
sightings.
Davy Jones's locker is what it makes me think of. And you got like all these like dead sailors and witches and all this stuff. You know what I mean? Like, it's on the Black Pearl or something that it's riding around on.
You know, and what is it with the people in South America? They're always obsessed with witches, it seems like,
It's part of their culture, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Remember the guy that we had on our show, Craig? And he actually described about being in the Navy, and he was a spotter. He actually saw an ancient Chinese ship come out of the fog one day. Remember that?
Yep.
I love stories like that.
Yeah, I love it.
It is really neat. But moving on to something that's real, unlike urban legends, don't get me wrong, I love them. I got to looking into some modern day sightings aboard cruise ships. You ever been on a cruise?
No, and there's another part to that story. I will never go on a cruise. My wife's going on one in a few months. I'm not going.
And reason why?
Is it because is it on the ocean? Yeah, not going. And it's for her birthday, folks. Yeah, my wife's birthday and our anniversary and all that stuff. It's one of these whole big things. She's going with friends. I ain't going. I'm like, look, I don't ask you to go do stuff with me that you don't want to go do. I don't. But it's our anniversary. I don't want to hear that crap, folks. I ain't going.
You're not going?
No, I'm not going.
Well, there's millions of people who do go on cruises, and this is some of their stories. Now, check these out. This is pretty cool. Check this out. This first one is called The Intruder. In August 2005, a man vacationing on the Thomas Destiny, which is now known as the Luis Olympia, had the fright of his life when he awoke to a stranger in his cabin. Now, however, there was something off about this intruder. It all started when the man awoke to the sound of the wardrobe doors swinging open. When the wardrobe door opened, it woke me up. So I sat up in bed and noticed a guy rummaging around in there. I shouted something out, and the guy, who had shoulder-length blonde hair and was wearing some sort of uniform, dived into the wardrobe. Now, the startled traveler jumped out of bed and was at the wardrobe in a matter of seconds. However, there was no trace of the intruder. A perplexing notion, as the wardrobe doors were still open and blocking access to the main cabin door. There was simply no way, the man reasoned, that the intruder had time to close the wardrobe door, open the locked cabin door, push the wardrobe door back open from the other side of the cabin, and then escape in the seconds it took him to jump out of the bed. He said, "When I checked the cabin and I realized it was physically impossible to get out, I soon became spooked and startled. Although reluctantly to think about it, I think it might have been a ghost." Now, he said, to add to this, around 6 a.m., my son sat up in bed and said to me, "You don't care about the people on this ship," and then went back to sleep. Now, I don't believe in ghosts, but if you had asked me my opinion right now, it might be a little different. So that's pretty crazy.
That's like really weird.
He saw something jump into his closet, and when he turned the lights on and stuff, it wasn't there.
No thanks.
Right?
Time to get a new... That's why you don't go... Another reason, you don't go cruising.
Here's another one.
Great.
A woman aboard the Carnival Conquest also had a frightening experience. It was around 5:30 p.m. on September 23rd, 2011, and the woman, who was staying with her husband in cabin 6412, had just finished dressing for dinner. As she admired her reflection in the mirror, the woman heard something strange. "I clearly heard a male's voice say, 'You look beautiful tonight.' I looked toward my husband, and he was on the balcony with the door shut. I looked at the TV, and it was on the menu channel playing only music. I blew it off, thinking that perhaps it was someone in the hall." Now, the woman continued to prepare for dinner, but she soon heard the compliment again. "You look beautiful tonight." Now, thoroughly frightened, the woman raced to the balcony and told her husband what she'd heard. Now, he believed her story, though he hadn't heard the voice, and the invisible entity didn't speak again. She goes on to say, "I've never heard voices in my life. In fact, most of the time, I do not hear very clearly at all, and I have to ask people to repeat what they said." Coincidentally, this happened an hour before a man overboard event happened on the same night. So, that's a creepy story. Could it be just a guy with like a peephole, you know, eavesdropping?
Right.
Or was it truly a ghost? I don't know.
"Hey, baby, you look good tonight."
I said, "Hey." Check this one out. Another cruise traveler, also aboard the Carnival Conquest. Well, that's kind of scary, right? Don't go sailing on the Carnival Conquest.
Yeah, apparently that one right there's got... I'd like to know the history of that.
Right? This took place in cabin number 2465. It says, "One night I went to dinner solo because my wife wasn't feeling well. When I returned, my wife asked if I had come back to the cabin for anything. I said I hadn't. She said, 'Well, someone touched me on the leg and woke me up.' However, I just blew it off. Now, after returning from the cruise, the man and his wife attended a seance with two other women. Strangely, one of the women asked if anyone had recently been on a cruise and if anything odd had happened. The man's wife related the touch in the cabin, and the woman said her aunt had died on the Carnival Conquest 2 years ago in cabin 2463. Now, the woman apparently communicated with Tina's spirit that night, and my wife asked why Tina had touched her. Tina said she was just trying to comfort her." That's pretty crazy, right?
That's a little unnerving, isn't it?
"My mother and I were on the Thompson Celebration. It was a beautiful day at sea, so I decided to go to the cinema on board. It was only us in the cinema, and we sat near the back. 10 minutes into the film, Three people walked into our left. They walked all the way down to the front as if looking for seats, even though there was only us in there. Then they walked back up and sat right behind us. As soon as they sat down, I told my mom we should move. As we got up to move, we realized there was no one in the row behind us. What? Ghost people just walking in the room?
People just strolling around?
Right. Very, very interesting. Here's another one on the Carnival Conquest. It says, my boyfriend and I just got off the Carnival Conquest, and we stayed in room 8364. We woke up in the middle of the night and found a tall man in what appeared to be a trench coat holding some sort of weapon in front of our bed.
Oh, look out, a fella in a trench coat. Right? Standing at the foot of the bed.
When we turned the lights on, there was nothing there. My boyfriend looked all over the room, but found no one. Now, earlier that night, my boyfriend said that he had saw someone open our door in the lit hallway and then close it softly. Now, other nights, I saw the shadow of what appeared to be a little girl standing next to the bed. Very creepy. We also heard someone banging on the walls and the window of our balcony. That's crazy. This is all going on the Carnival Conquest. I mean, if you're a ghost hunter, you need to try to book the Carnival Conquest. Very.
Why? Right. Let's. That would be interesting to go out there on. Okay, let me put this out there. Is it because of whatever these spirits are they on the ship? Or are they just traveling through areas where there's more spirits just kind of piling on? Maybe that, you know what I'm saying? Like from haunted spot to haunted spot?
Is it that, or is it just other people that are on the cruise that are drunk and they're actually going to the wrong cabin?
Well,
and
I guess
this guy's
that could
searching
be.
Around in this guy's closet and like, yeah. Oh, crap, I'm not.
Oh, here. He saw me. Oh, God.
You know, I guess stranger things could have happened. It yeah. doesn't even tell. I mean, maybe the people that thought that they saw this were actually drunk, you know?
That's creepy, man.
I don't know.
To be on vacation and
stuff
like that.
Thinking there's people coming in and out of your room. Yeah. Ugh. One more. On Saturday, April 25th, 2015, my girlfriend and I sailed on the Carnival Conquest. We had a startling experience. We were about to make love when we heard our cabin door opening and closing. My girlfriend asked, did someone just enter our cabin? We looked in the darkness and heard the safe and cabinet door slam open. Now, mind you, this cabinet and safe were open for 7 nights and never slammed, even in the rough seas. In the dark, I could make out a steward with his hand in the safe, watching us. I asked my girlfriend if she saw him. She turned on the lights, but the apparition was gone. When we heard the cabin door close, even though no light came from the corridor, we prayed, and we weren't bothered again, but the hair stood up on our necks. Our cabin number was 2312. Two other people in our party had strange experiences on deck. And if you were curious, we still made love. It was our last night, ghost or no ghost, I'm still going. That's what it says.
I was just thinking, you talk about ruining a moment, but maybe that guy's like, nah, even a ghost don't stop me, baby.
Nah, you got to move forward. You know what I mean?
That's
you can't
right.
a little ghost action little, mess
get,
with you.
Get a little scared. Can get a little bit scared.
They should have even stopped. They should have just kept going while the ghost yeah. was in the looking at him.
I'm going to give you a show there, Casper.
Very interesting. I need to get, I don't need to book a trip on the Carnival Conquest. That sounds terrifying, but maybe that ship is still in service. And if you're interested in ghosts, you can go book and get some of those rooms. Very interesting. Well, thanks everybody for listening to that. Let's take a break. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Very interesting stories. I hope if somebody is to take a cruise and they... see a ghost or something that they write the show.
If you've got any ghost right. stories from cruises or vacations like that where you've been on, if yeah. you've ever seen a ghost in a plane, if you ever seen a ghost on a ship, I don't know. You ever eat them in a box? You ever eat them with a fox? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
Send them. I would like to read those.
I would too. Very interesting stories. I enjoy them. I love the listener stories.
Pretty Kyle, cool. I got you something here you're going to get a kick out of.
Yeah, please.
Here in closing, everybody's always bagging on me. You know, about not wanting to go swimming and never, you know, I'm not getting in the ocean because of sharks and this, that, and the other. And everybody's like, oh, you know, you got more luck doing this and doing that. And you can give me all the stats you want. I don't care about your stats. This actually comes from Florida Man. This is why I also don't go swimming in a pool, Kyle.
Okay.
Now, I would love to know exactly how to pronounce this, but this comes apparently from the South Florida Sun Sentinel. I guess it's Hapaluxo, Florida. I don't know. It's some wild name. But anyway, wildlife officials are trying to figure out exactly how a shark got into a swimming pool at a South Florida condo complex. That they reported that Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission responded to the Mariners K condominium about two weeks ago, and says after a woman found a live 5-foot-long black-tipped shark in the swimming pool.
Really?
She told the officers that she saw two young men running away from the pool, which is located near the shoreline of the intercoastal waterway. Now, it says that they removed the shark from the pool and, of course, returned it back to the ocean. Apparently, it's a very common shark down there in that area in coastal Florida, is this black tip. But that's just, now imagine this. Imagine you got this black tip. He's in there in the pool.
Mm-hmm.
You're smashed. You're down there in Florida on vacay. You are hammered drunk. I'm going to go get in the pool for a little quick dip, baby.
Right.
And you jump off in that pool, and what happens? Then this black tip just takes a foot off for you. That's, no. See, no. There's,
then it would have to be a saltwater pool, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, that or it's just a real tough shark. And after a while, it just decided, you know, and maybe it was going to kill it. Who knows? I don't know. I don't care. I'd like to have found it floating, maybe. Of course, they don't float. They sink, you know, but that's a whole different. That's just another reason. Don't go swimming, folks. You know where sharks don't get you? In the shower. The shark don't come down. Of course, it always makes me think of that Saturday Night Live skit from like the old 80s.
The land shark?
The land shark. Yeah. Bing, bong. You know, they open the door and grab them. But that's just the whole thing. So I saw that. Only in Florida. Only with Florida man. Two Florida men. Now look, were those two people running away? Did they put the shark there? Or did they go for a quick dip and was like, oh! And then took off running when they saw the shark? Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
Folks, for all of y'all that are going to be out and about this spring, up around Eureka Springs, Arkansas, there's an Ozark Mountain UFO conference. Now, we spoke about this on the Thursday show. Kyle and I are going April 8th through the 10th of this year, 2016. We're going to go, folks. And it looks like it is going to be a blast. The 29th annual one. Let me give you a list of speakers. There's several that's going to be there. Linda Moulton Howe is a keynote speaker. Of course, you know, D-Man, the Dolan, Jim Mars is going to be there. We got Nick Pope, what we discussed some of his stuff on the last Thursday show. But we're really excited because Eric Von Daniken is going to be speaking there. Now, there's a list of other speakers that are going to be there. But, folks, if y'all are anywhere close or if y'all are thinking about going, hit us up. We're going to be there. We're trying to see if we can get Micah Hanks to come go with us. We're going to try to drag Micah up there with us. But either way, we're going to be there. Kyle and I are going to be out there hanging out, listening to a bunch of stuff talk, probably having a few mixed drinks, probably having a, you know, maybe a steak and tater or something like that. We don't know yet. But if you see us, please come talk to us. We would love to kind of meet y'all and intermix with anybody that's going to be there. So just holler. But we're going to be at the Ozark Mountain UFO Conference. So if you can search it up, I think it's OzarkUFOConference.com. But anyway, we're going to be up there. It looks like it's going to be fun.
I'm super excited because, you know, we had plans for the Paradigm Symposium.
Right,
that thing got canceled. So we didn't get to do it. We lost a ton of money. We lost all our airfare and everything. And so luckily this is a conference where we don't have to fly. We can drive. It's about a 5-hour drive, and me and Cam, we're definitely going to go up there. Yep. So if you're up there, we would love to visit with you. If you like today's story, and like we mentioned, if you have any ghost stories of your own you would like to share, you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can email the show directly by going to the website, expandedperspectives.com, and clicking on the contact information there. You can pass your story along. If you'd like to call the show and leave your story, you can call us 817-945-3828. And if it's a really good one, we might find it played during one of our breaks. Cam, do you have any idea what we're going to be talking about this Thursday?
No, I've got several things. Like I always talk about it. I've got several things in the books of what I'm looking at, but I don't know. I can't nail it down. It's whatever grabs me, whatever grabs my fancy before we get started. That's about it.
Yeah, I know. And we got an interesting interview this week with the Blurry Photos guy. Yep. So that's going to be cool. We'll be looking for that coming out on an upcoming show. And it's going to be a lot of fun. For everybody that's a member of Expanded Perspectives Elite, we'll be speaking to you on Thursday. For everybody else, have a good week, and we'll talk to you next Monday. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace.